So this morning, to open the scriptures, we have one of our own in our community. One of the values that we have is we want more voices in our community opening the scriptures. And so Nick Acosta, he is an educator. He has a family married to Brittany and two beautiful children. All children are beautiful, but theirs are very beautiful. As beautiful as all children. Very beautiful. And when Nick and I were prepping for this morning, I think we had some Enneagram conversations. And we think Nick is probably a five, which is kind of like the expert, the investigator. And then Nick thinks, he said, you would be okay if I said this. He thinks you might be a seven, Brittany, which I'm a seven, which is the adventurer, the optimist. And so let's welcome up Nick Acosta this morning.
Thank you. If you were here last Sunday, Jason Minnick spoke about power and privilege. And we got to hear from some voices in the community from different ethnic backgrounds. And then that same afternoon, we had a conversation more specific to the African-American experience. And then we had a vigil for the recent victims of police violence in the African-American community. And for me personally, I felt like the whole day was really encouraging, even if it was kind of difficult to work through some of that stuff. It made me really happy to be part of this community. So today I'm going to try to continue that same conversation, but kind of take a step back and look at the bigger question of what is justice? What does it mean when we talk about justice? And we're going to let the text, the lectionary text this week in Amos kind of guide our conversation about that. So justice is a really broad concept. It kind of depends on what context or imagery we're using for justice kind of shapes what we mean by it. So one really dominant image that we know of for justice in the West is Lady Justice right here. You might see this in front of government buildings. And Lady Justice has a scale, which means it's about weighing things. She's got a sword because of retribution. And then usually she's blindfolded, which means that she's blind. Justice is supposed to be blind. Another idea of justice that we have, it's a really American idea. A lot of times we say justice, we really mean criminal justice. I feel like a good image for this is like the old sheriff in the West, right? So here's Rooster Cogburn from True Grit. And this kind of justice is, it's a little looser and sloppier than the Lady Justice image, but it gets the job done. And this justice is kind of about like cracking down on crime, showing the bad guys who's boss. I think behind that is this idea of bringing order to chaos, right? Like, the Wild West was a crazy place and needed justice to come and like create some order. So, and we like that. We're thankful that happened because now the West has won. Now we get to enjoy things like chilies and medieval times. But then a lot of times justice is thrown around in pop culture and it's less clear what we mean by it. Like this, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. I saw this movie and if I were to just try to like isolate this movie and ask, what does justice mean? You know, what is it exactly that's dawning? I think I would say maybe power. Everything about this movie is about power, like physical, mental, political. And what's supposed to be hopeful about the movie really just comes down to the fact that Batman and Superman are powerful. And there's not really much beneath the surface. So here, justice means power and maybe really bad expository dialogue or something. So let's see if we can kind of set these images of justice aside as we open up the scriptures in Amos, which is pretty heavy on the idea of justice. So let's go ahead and do what we like to do around here and take turns reading this out loud to each other. Okay, so the text says, in the beginning it says that Amos is saying, the Lord showed me a basket of summer fruit. And then he says, the end has come. And then this is actually a play on words, because in the Hebrew, the word for basket and the word for the end are very similar. So it's a play on words, but it's also symbolic, because he's talking about the whole nation like it's this basket of fruit. And you might have different groups within that basket. Let's say you have like the merchant class, they're like figs, and the peasants are grapes, and let's say the sailors are, I don't know, apples or something. But we're talking about the whole basket, which is an interesting image, because what it's suggesting is that justice is a systemic thing. It's about everybody. It's about the whole basket. It makes more sense to think about what we're doing rather than what you or I am doing. And we're either part of a basket that's practicing justice or we're not.
So to stay in this metaphor, one particular basket that I'm a part of is my family. Here's my family. It's a little dated. And we're a big family, and I kind of think that every family has its own dysfunctions, and those dysfunctions are actually what make families like interesting and unique. One particular dysfunction my family has is we're really bad at communicating. We really like each other. We have a really good time when we're around, but when it comes to getting information out, we just really kind of break down as a group. And like planning a big trip together is just a disaster. It's just too much information to get around to too many different people. And one time in particular shows what I mean by this dysfunction. About 10 years ago, my dad went in for a hernia operation. Nothing super serious or critical. You know, it's surgery. Surgeries are important. And the day the surgery comes, I call my mom to check in. Everything's fine. Routine procedure. A few days later, my mom and one of my brothers are talking on the phone. I don't know who called who. And my brother's like, "How's everything?" And she's like, "You know, it's fine, kind of busy. I think Luxie might have been potty training at the time. And you know, your dad's recovering well from his surgery." And he's like, "What? Surgery? Dad had surgery?" It turns out no one told my brother that his father was having surgery. And he starts to get understandably a little upset, right? Like, how could you not tell me? And my mom didn't even occur to her that he didn't know. And you know, so she's like, "Well, I told three of the brothers, and you know, reasonably assumed, you know, cause y'all talk to each other more than you talk to me. So it's kind of fair to assume that." And this is back in the day of like, actually like there's no group texts, no Slack or anything. So she's actually like dialing numbers that she had memorized. Remember that? Like memorizing phone numbers. And then so it starts to look like maybe the rest of us brothers are at fault because we didn't talk to him. And he's like, "You know, did you not think it was important enough to me?" And then so at this point, we're starting to dig up like real family issues. Like, "You thought I didn't care. You're making too much." You know, so this is like an actual family problem. It's not one of those like little cute anecdotes of how bad we are at communicating. "Oh, look how bad we are like planning a meal. You know, like no one brought a salad, but we all brought baguettes." It's not like that, right? This is like an actual like feelings are being hurt. And so what's happening is, so we're this basket of fruit, and we have is the banana is upset at the mango for not calling the banana. And the banana is like, "Maybe you should talk to the blueberries," and the blueberries, but what we're saying, not saying is, "Well, maybe if the banana called the mango more often, this wouldn't have been a problem. Mango's got that brand new fancy flip phone, that new Motorola Razr, you know, at least it could do is call the mango every now and then." And so as long as we're thinking about in terms of what the individual pieces of fruit are doing, we're missing the point, because this is a systemic problem. We have a communication problem as a family. So we need to start thinking of this in terms of like what is going on with the basket. So for example, let's talk about something systemic like how housing discrimination in the 1940s and 50s, you can draw a direct effect that has on present day racial inequality. So for example, if you were a World War II veteran, came back from the war, whether you were black or white, you would have had enough money to buy a house to start a family. But the kind of house that you would have been able to buy would have been very different based on the color of your skin. So this is a typical housing development in the 50s. And a lot of these real estate developers, they got government subsidies to keep costs down because they wanted to grow the middle class. And these are lovely houses. And so a lot of World War II vets were buying houses like this. But if you happen to be African American, you wouldn't have been able to buy one of these houses. You would have been able to buy a house in a sanctioned like African American neighborhood, like the next slide. And these developments didn't get any government subsidy. And the cities actually neglected these neighborhoods. They didn't pick up the trash as often, so they were kind of dirty. And you wouldn't think it, but the housing here was actually more expensive than white housing, because you have a finite number of houses, demand is up. So when that happens, cost goes up, right? So it would have been more expensive to live in worse housing. Fast forward a few decades, the houses in these white developments appreciate in value several times the rate of the houses in these neighborhoods. And so there you have one World War II vet who has an inheritance to leave his kids and grandkids, and the other World War II vet who happens to have darker skin does not have that inheritance to leave. So they have like one aspect of the history of racial inequality in this country. So let's say we talk about this And I keep wanting to talk about the fact that, well, I'm just a blueberry and I worked for everything I have, right? Or I could even say something like, I happen to give a lot of money to a charity that does really good things in the Apple community or whatever. Like, as long as I'm thinking like that, I'm missing the point. This is a basket of fruit. This is a systemic problem. And we need to learn how to think about the big picture, think about the system. So I wonder how can we be better at thinking in terms of systems, of systemic justice? How I think about things that we all kind of share responsibility for. Because it's easy to talk about what I'm doing, but it takes a little bit more work to think about things on the basket level. So the text goes on. It says, hear this, you that trample on the needy and bring ruin to the poor of the land, saying, when will the new moon be over so that we may again sell grain? And the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale, we will make the ephah small and the shekel great, and practice deceit with false balances, saying, the poor, buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and selling the sweepings of the wheat. So the main injustice that Amos is criticizing here is that they're bringing ruin to the poor of the land. So this one history, this kingdom Israel, they've split into two. There's a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. You can see there. And the north, you know, there's like a dynastic split at some point. But at this point, the north, they're kind of in their prime. They've been strengthening their geopolitical position. They're starting, as you can see, starting to push into their neighbors' lands. They're not getting pushed around like they used to be. And they're able to do all this because they had made these changes to their economy. And what you had was this merchant class. So before, the poor, they would live on their own land, farm their own land, and have their own food. They were subsistence farmers, and it worked for them. But you had this new class that was pushing the poor off their land to farm other land that could produce things like oil and wine for a profit. And then the poor would get money and then go to a market to buy their food that they needed. But what it's saying is these people making these changes are... they're saying, we will make the ephah small and the shekel great and practice deceit with false balances. So the ephah, that's a unit of volume. So I would go and buy one ephah of wheat. And then a shekel is how much I pay for. That's a unit of money. So what they're basically saying is they're changing the rules of the market so you pay more to get less. And so first of all, you're forcing them to use the market. Second of all, you're rigging the market to make it more favorable for the rich. And what's interesting is that this actually worked. This actually worked for the economy. It was good on the whole, as you can see. Like they were more powerful, but it's still an injustice because it was all done on the backs of the poor. And it's not just an injustice; it's like the big injustice. And it's so big that Amos is saying that God is saying that Israel's time is just over. This northern kingdom is just going to be over. And the reason it seems that this is so important is that all throughout the Bible, justice favors the poor of the land. It's not blind like Lady Justice. It's not detached. It actually is very engaged and has its eyes open. It's actively biased towards the weak and the poor, or people who are in whatever way out of the spheres of power. This group of people, they were persecuted by the Egyptians, and then God took their side against the Egyptians because they were the persecuted. And then all throughout the Torah, you hear this teaching that says, take care of the foreigners and the poor, because that's who you used to be. You know, don't forget who you are. And it even goes as far as to say that, like, later in this book, Amos is telling them, didn't God also create the Ammonites and the Aramaeans and the Philistines? Like, aren't they also God's people? Which is really shocking to hear if you're this original audience, because you've always thought you were the favorite people. And what Amos is saying is, no, you've actually forgotten who you are. You were the favorite people because you were the oppressed. And now you've turned into the oppressors. So you've gotten a little power, and you don't know who you are anymore. There's a theologian from Peru named Gustavo Gutierrez, who I think is helpful in thinking through this idea of what does it mean for justice to favor the poor. He is credited for starting this movement called Liberation Theology in Latin America in the 60s. And what you had was these Catholic priests who saw this systemic injustice, and they wanted to find a better way to connect the gospel with what was actually happening in the world. So Gutierrez has an interesting story. You can't tell from this picture, but he's actually really short. He's like less than 5 feet tall. He had a debilitating bone disease when he was growing up, and he spent all of his years as a teenager in bed. And he was a priest in this neighborhood here, called Rimac, which is one of the roughest slums of Lima in Peru. And even though in 1971, he published his book and became like this world famous theologian, and they had him as a visiting professor in Notre Dame and Europe. He never left this parish. He kept working as their priest until he retired. He felt like these were his people. He even went as far as says he felt like they taught him more about who God was than those professional theologians he studied under. And one of the big ideas he has that sticks with me is he says we've been misunderstanding what it means to take care of the poor. We usually think that it has to do with ethics because of like it's the right moral thing to do. And Christians are supposed to be moral people, so we do this good moral thing. But it's actually not about that. It's actually about it's about theology. It's about who God is and who we are as God's people. And he says that we're supposed to dignify and be near those who are suffering or outside of the spheres of power. Because when we don't, we're not understanding what the gospel means. And then so in the Northern Kingdom and Amos, they forgot who they were because they forgot the poor. Gutierrez says, of a quote, he says, "The center of the world, so-called because the crucified Jesus dwells there, and with him all who suffer unjustly, is the place from which we must proclaim the risen Lord." So the cross is a place of unjust suffering, and it's the center of the world. And if you're not near that place, it's going to be just a little bit harder for you to understand what the gospel means, what it is that it's proclaiming to the world. If you weren't here last Sunday during the afternoon, one of the people we got to hear from was Jason Ikpat's sister, Paula, who came in from Houston to talk to us. And she talked about her experience studying at A&M. And she remembers being in a classroom her spring semester senior year. She's about to graduate. And hearing comments from students about how certain people are only there because they were minorities. And they're not mentioning names, but she's the only African-American in the room. And she's thinking, I've been taking all these same classes with all these people, and all of a sudden I feel invisible. I feel like a skin color, and that's it. And then she talked about being part of a majority white church in Houston. And she said they're really great people, even though there was kind of it was kind of hard to relate to some people sometimes. She really enjoyed being there. It was a really encouraging community. And at one point, this community tries to have a conversation about racial reconciliation, and they kind of totally miss the point in their conversation because they have so little perspective on the issue. And she said she tried to speak up and educate people as she could, but in case you didn't know, that can actually get exhausting after a while. So what she said was she just learned to hold her head high with grace and go back into the church and forgive people because they didn't know that they were wrong. And as I'm hearing Paula Ikpat tell the story, I'm just thinking, that's the gospel. Like that's what it means. And she understands something about that that I don't understand. So what Gutierrez is saying is you don't just stand with those who are outside of power because it's the right thing to do. You stand with them because you actually might learn something about who you are, about who God is. So I wonder, how can we find ways to be near and stand with those who are outside of power? And how can we get past this, honestly, kind of condescending idea that, you know, we're the ones deigning to help them, but actually realizing that we're learning from each other, that they have something they're blessing us. So how can we listen to those experiences and what are they asking of us? The text continues. "On that day, says the Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your feasts into mourning and all your songs into lamentation. I will bring sackcloth on all loins and baldness on every head. I will make it like the morning for an only son and the end of it like a bitter day. The time is surely coming, says the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread or a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. They shall wander from the sea to sea and from north to east. They shall run to and fro, seeking the word of the Lord, but they shall not find it." So we have here is a, we have a list of the consequences of injustice. And these consequences are spiritual. You know, you're going to mourn. Your songs are going to be turned to lamentation. But they're also physical consequences. The sun is going to go down. There's going to be baldness on every head. They're going to wander around without a home. And what this is bringing up is the fact that justice is about souls, but it's also about bodies. So spiritual and physical reality, they both matter. And again, I think Gustavo Gutierrez is really helpful in understanding this, because he talks about you can't separate physical from spiritual salvation. And this is, he says, salvation concerns all humanity and the whole of the human person. The liberating action of Christ made human in this single history, and not in a history marginal to the real lives of humans, is in the heart of the historical flow of humankind. The struggle for a just society is written into the history of salvation. So salvation is about the whole person, physical and spiritual reality. And you can see this in Jesus' ministry, right? He goes around forgiving sins and driving out demons, but he's also healing the sick and calling out injustice. And so Gutierrez's contemporaries in the 60s, they were telling him things like, we're not here to mess with you know, things of systemic injustice. But what they're actually saying is, we care about people's souls, but we don't care about their bodies. So I had the opportunity to go to Ghana in West Africa when I was in college. And while I was there, I was invited to go with some of the Christians to reach out to this little village. And I remember I was on this long drive to this place in the middle of the savannah, and it's like one of those really bumpy third world country roads. And I remember I had a book, but I couldn't read it because I was getting so carsick. But I also didn't have any music, so all I could do was just look out the window, which is actually kind of awesome because there are all these acacia trees. And if you've never seen an acacia tree in real life, they're massive. They're just amazing. So I'm on this van. At one point, the van stops and picks up some people, and there's this woman with a chicken, and she has me hold her chicken for her. And I'm sitting there like with this chicken. I'm like, am I in a photo shoot for a brochure or something? Like, this is way too picturesque for me right now. So we get to this little village, and it's in the middle of nowhere, and we learn that this village has no immediate access to fresh water. And they take us on this walk. It's like a mile long this dusty trail. And we get to this little pond, which is their water supply, and it's still, and you can see things floating in it. It's pretty filthy. And that's their water supply. You have to make that walk and carry it back in these clay jugs every day. And because the water is so unsanitary, a lot of the little kids had engorged stomachs because of intestinal worms. And more than half of the kids didn't live past the age of 5 in this village. And then so we're meeting with this village, and at one point, one of the people from our group, he gets up and he starts teaching, he starts preaching. And I just remember sitting there, and I couldn't really, I don't know what he was saying. It was really hard for me to focus on what he was saying because I was so distracted by this idea that I have no idea what it's like to raise a toddler and know that you probably don't have a 5th birthday to plan for. Like that idea does not even like fit in my imagination. And then afterward we get in the van, we drive home, and everyone's feeling good about how well this trip went. And for me, I just have this uneasy feeling, and I don't know why, but something just didn't feel right about it. I just couldn't put my finger on it. And it wasn't until I started reading Gustavo Gutierrez that it made sense to me, or it made sense to me why that didn't make sense to me. And what he's saying is that we were doing good things, tending to their spiritual needs, but we were ignoring their physical needs. So we're basically sharing half the gospel with them. So maybe if we really wanted to do something effective, maybe we could have taken them. I mean, there's a lot of things we could have done differently. Maybe you start by taking them Bibles, but you also take them tanks of water and some medicine. Or if you really want to stand with them and dignify them, you learn who these people are and their history and why this particular tribe was moved off its ancestral lands and why they didn't have access to water in the first place. Who are the local power players in Ghanaian politics? Who is advocating for them? You know, then you can actually start to understand what are the systemic injustices here. I usually don't like to use labels like liberal and conservative, but I think this issue actually brings up, it highlights this divide that we've seen for a lot of Christianity over the last 100 years. And I think you could kind of simplify it to say that classic liberals and classic conservatives emphasize the soul, but ignore the body. And classic liberals emphasize the body, but forget the soul. So, for example, you have like the example I just mentioned, but also in this country in the 60s, you had a lot of churches that were actually very politically active when it came to keeping gambling and strip clubs out of their neighborhoods. But then when civil rights exploded, they weren't saying anything. And then you have the other extreme, which is in Latin America, you actually had Catholic priests who really liked Gustavo Gutierrez, and they took it so far that you get to a point where you have priests joining Marxist guerrilla groups and handing out Kalashnikovs to people. And so they get to the point, they're so obsessed with the physical reality of injustice that they've lost any sense of spiritual transcendence. And I think when you forget that spiritual side, it makes it harder to live in grace. And so I think, going back to Paula Ikpat's story, I think her ability to keep walking into that church with grace and forgive people, I think she has to have a sense that there's a spiritual reality that's big enough to encompass physical reality. That spiritual and physical justice, it's all one and the same. And it's not that it's like both, it's actually the same. Spiritual reality has physical implications. Physical reality has a spiritual dimension. So I wonder if there's a third way past this duality. And I have to say, I don't really know what that looks like. Gideon and I have been having conversations the past few weeks about justice, and we don't really agree on certain things. We're not really experts on this. But one thing we do know is we should probably listen to people who do have things to say about poverty, about what works, what are some needs. But I think as we have these conversations, we should try to keep this voice of Scripture as part of the conversation. What is justice in the first place that we're bringing to this conversation? I mentioned in the beginning some images for justice, Lady Justice being blind and detached, the Wild West justice being about bringing order to chaos. But I'd like to offer one more image of justice. And this is from a story by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who is my favorite author just of all time. It's magical realism, so it's a little weird, so bear with me. This story is called The Handsomest Drowned Man in the World. And it's about this village in Colombia on the beach, and they see this dead body that's washed ashore, and they go to check it out, and they see that he's actually a giant, and he's actually not decomposing, and he actually happens to be the most beautiful man they've ever seen. And they decide they need to make a funeral for this guy, but they're kind of annoyed because it's like an inconvenience, and he's not really our responsibility, and we can't find any funeral clothes that fit him or a coffin that he fits in. And as they're doing this, as they're giving him this funeral, the idea of who this person must have been starts to work on their imagination. And they think, if he's an inconvenience to us now as a dead body, I wonder how inconvenient he would have been to people in real life. He must have been like breaking people's furniture and not fitting in their houses and stuff. So they think he must have been marginalized. And they start to think about how would we have marginalized him? And are there people that we're marginalizing? And so this person kind of comes alive in their imagination. They name him Esteban. And as you do this, their village starts to transform. So I'm going to have Claudia Harding come up and read the last part of this story.
That was how they came to hold the most splendid funeral they could conceive of for an abandoned, drowned man. Some women who had gone to get flowers in the neighboring villages returned with other women who could not believe what they had been told, and those women went back for more flowers when they saw the dead man, and they brought more and more until there were so many flowers and so many people that it was hard to walk about. At the final moment, it pained them to return him to the waters as an orphan, and so they chose a father and mother from among the best people, and aunts and uncles and cousins, so that through him, all the inhabitants of the village became kinsmen. Some sailors who heard the weeping from a distance went off course, and people heard of one who had himself tied to the mainmast, remembering ancient fables about sirens. While they fought for the privilege of carrying him on their shoulders along the steep escarpment by the cliffs, men and women became aware for the first time of the desolation of their streets, the dryness of their courtyards, the narrowness of their dreams as they face the splendor and beauty of their drowned man. They let him go without an anchor so that he could come back if he wished and whenever he wished. And they all held their breath for the fraction of centuries the body took to fall into the abyss. They did not need to look at one another to realize that they were no longer all present, that they would never be. But they also knew that everything would be different from then on, that their houses would have wider doors, higher ceilings, and stronger floors, so that Esteban's memory could go everywhere without bumping into beams, and so that no one in the future would dare whisper, "The big boob finally died. Too bad. The handsome fool has finally died." Because they were going to paint their house fronts gay colors to make Esteban's memory eternal. And they were going to break their backs, digging for springs among the stones and planting flowers on the cliffs so that in future years at dawn, the passengers on great liners would awaken, suffocated by the smell of gardens on the high seas. And the captain would have to come down from the bridge in his dress uniform with his astrolabe, his pole star, and his row of war medals. And, pointing to the promontory of roses on the horizon, he would say in 14 languages, "Look there, where the wind is so peaceful now that it's gone to sleep beneath the beds. Over there, where the sun's so bright that the sunflowers don't know which way to turn. Yes, over there, that's Esteban's village."
And so this village, they noticed the most insignificant kind of person, a dead body. And they started to realize the dignity that he deserved. They started to create room for him in their imagination. And as they did this, as Esteban's memory works in the village, they suddenly became a place of beauty. And That's my prayer for Vox Venier, that as we hear the call of justice, we learn to have room in our imagination for those outside of the spheres of power. As we listen to that call, that we would be transformed into a community of beauty. I'll close this out with a prayer from Martin Luther King Jr. God, we thank you for the inspiration of Jesus. Grant that we will love you with all of our hearts, souls, and minds, and love our neighbors as we love ourselves, even our enemy neighbors. And we ask you, God, in these times of emotional tension, when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail, to be with us in our going out and our coming in our rising up and in our lying down, in our moments of joy and in our moments of sorrow, until a day when there shall be no sunset and no dawn. Amen.